بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم. Welcome everybody. Thank you for joining us. We are continuing with our sessions on the Mawaqif of Al-Iji, our seminars on mature Islamic philosophical theology, or as we like to call it, the walk through the Mawaqif. Thank you all for joining us. Today, Sheikh Hamza Karamali will lead us through the chapter on the Jawahir, which he calls them, sorry, what do you call them again? The contingent objects? Yeah, otherwise known as substances. And this is related to our previous session on contingent properties. So without further ado, I'll pass it on to Sheikh Hamza. Jazakumullah khairan.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله وسلم على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. So okay. So this is the where today is a it's there's going to be a lot of today's going to be an advanced seminar because there's going to be some philosophy, some kalam, some science, some history of science, some history of philosophy. I'm going to tie in a lot of things. And so this is the fourth mawqif from the six mawaqif. And this one is on al-jawahir. And I have my own idiosyncratic translation of it as a contingent object. And I'll explain why I translated it as a contingent object. It could also be translated as substance, which might be more understandable, but there's a pitfall. So this fourth mawqif is the mawqif in of the six mawaqif that is most in need of updating, and it is somebody who's studied the history of science will just come here and at first glance it'll be a head shake. There's a lot of Aristotelian mistakes that are mentioned here, but if you look at it a little bit more carefully, you'll see that the mutakallimun, they weren't like the Thomists, they weren't like the Christians who had appropriated Aristotle. The mutakallimun were free thinkers. They're scientifically, they were free of many assumptions that the Aristotelians held. And this is an important concept, because what I think we can take from this is that the mutakallimun, they allow us to free ourselves from certain assumptions in modern science as well. And I'll demonstrate how that happens. So this one, he says, this is the table of contents at the end. I'll be going back and forth between the table of contents, and we'll do a couple of deep dives in certain sections of the Mawaqif, and to get an idea of what he's doing, why he's doing it, and what it means for us today. So he says, Al-Mawqif al-Rabi' fil Jawahir wa fihi muqaddimatun wa marasid. So Adud al-Din al-Iji, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have mercy on him and benefit us through him. He said that the fourth mawqif is on Jawahir. So the word, let's look at the muqaddimah. So we're gonna go to page 182. This corresponds to 186 because of the PDF numbering. So, fil Jawahir. So he gives the Jawhar, it means, let's take substance. So the idea here is that I have a thing. They're the things in the universe. They undergo change. So you have a seed. It turns into a sapling and then a tree. Or you have a house that's beautifully built and then it decomposes and turns into ruins. And you have a human being who is born a child and then grows into an old man. So there's change that is happening. The physical world is full of change. So Aristotle, he inherited a Greek philosophical tradition and he spoke in its context. So the pre-Socratics, so the Sheikh of Aristotle is Plato, and the Sheikh of Plato is Socrates. And then you have these ancient Greek philosophers, the pre-Socratics. Among them, there were various discussions about the possibility of change. One of the prominent pre-Socratics, he said that change is impossible because when something changes, then the thing that it changes to is no longer the thing that it used to be. And so you have a new thing, and something has ceased to exist and something new has come into existence. But that's a paradox, that's a contradiction. And this paradox, it was dealt with by various philosophers before and after Aristotle. And in light of that, he had a philosophy of change. And he said that there's continuity. He said there's continuity. Things, when they change, they remain the same thing, but there's the thing that changes is its form. So he has a theory of matter and form. So let's see. He says that that there is, the universe is made up of, the physical universe is made up of something called, they call it Hayula. We're going to come to Hayula. Hayula is prime matter. It's this continuous thing. It's this continuous thing that, and then there's this thing called a form. So when a particular kind of form inheres in this prime matter, it becomes a seed, and then it becomes a sapling, and then it becomes a tree. So the matter, the prime matter, is the same. According to Aristotle, it's eternal. It doesn't have a beginning. It's continuous. It's not discrete. And change and the identity, when you have matter and form, the form changes, but the underlying matter remains the same. And there's various kinds of form. And so he uses this to explain the continuity of identity as objects change. So his theory of what the physical universe is constituted by is complex. And we're going to do an overview in order to understand what the mutakallimun are saying, because they're speaking in this context. So he talks about jauhar, right? Jauhar. So he says, qal al-hukama. So the word jauhar has two different meanings. It has one meaning according to the hukama. Who are the hukama? Hukama are Avicenna, Ibn Sina, who inherited Aristotle through a particular intellectual tradition. So you can call them the Aristotelians. The hukama are the falasifa, the Muslim Aristotelians, and also the ancient Greek philosophers. All of them, they're called the hukama. And they're opposite to the hukama. The people who are engaging with the hukama are the mutakallimun, the Muslim theologians. So the hukama, they have a historical definition of jauhar, and that historical definition of jauhar is what we would translate now as substance. So the jauhar is the substance. You have a substance and you have its properties. So Dr. Haroon, in the previous lecture, he talked about properties, and there's something called substance. So the substance, it has one meaning in the tradition of the ancient Aristotelians. It actually has a different meaning in the tradition of the Mutakallimun. The same word is appropriated and used in a different meaning. This has a, I have a observation, just a side observation to make about that in terms of translation. In terms of translations, sometimes there's an argument that's made. So I believe that when we are translating kalam terms, we should use the language of modern philosophy. And an objection that's raised to this is that these terms in modern philosophy, they have a history, and when we use them for kalam, they don't mean exactly the same thing. So people will misunderstand it. So we should use medieval terms such as substance, such as accident, things that somebody would associate with Aristotle. But I think that's a
That's not a good approach. And the practice of the mutakallimun themselves shows that they did something different. What did they do? They went to the dominant philosophy of their time, which is the philosophy of the Aristotelians, and they took the same words, but they used them in different meanings. And these two meanings, we see them in our intellectual history. And why did they do that? They did that because when you use a particular word, you appropriate a word and you use it in a new meaning, but it's used in a particular meaning in the contemporary intellectual context, you've located the term. So somebody who comes and sees the word Johar, even though it won't mean the same thing as the Johar of Aristotle, will understand where it fits in the larger philosophical scheme of things. And that allows for a high quality intellectual encounter. We need to do the same thing in our times. When we take these terms and we translate them using their medieval equivalents, what we end up doing is we say that kalam belongs to the past. Kalam is an artifact of the past. It's something that was relevant in the Aristotelian debates. But when somebody, a modern philosopher, looks at these terms and he sees them used in their ancient, in that medieval context, he's going to automatically dismiss them. He'll say, we're done with that. We're done with Aristotle. It's old news. We've moved beyond that. We're talking about other things now. But when you take that same term and you translate it in terms of a modern philosophical vocabulary, and so you call it contingent object, then what you're doing is you're locating it in a contemporary philosophical context. And now you can define it in your own way, but there's an engagement that's possible that a medieval translation would hinder. It would come in the way of that engagement. And so that's what's happening here. The mutakallimun, they're taking the word Johar, but you're going to see that it has two completely different meanings. The word Johar means something very different for the hukama than it does for the mutakallimun. What does it mean for the hukama? The hukama, he says, qala al-hukama, al-jawhar, substance, in other words, there's two kinds of substances. So there's the Aristotelians, this goes back to Aristotle, there's something called there's material substance, and there's immaterial substance. So immaterial substance, in Arabic, we call this Jauhar Mujarrad. Something that's immaterial, Jauhar Mujarrad, is a kind of substance that does not occupy space. It doesn't have a location. So the material substances, this constitutes the physical universe. So physical objects, so this cell phone or this pen or this misbaha, they add an Islamic twist to philosophy. This is, according to Aristotle, subhanAllah, a misbaha analyzed using Aristotelian philosophy. So the never thought the day would come. So Aristotle, the Aristotelians, they would say that this is a material substance. This is a jism. Jism, I'm going to translate as physical object. I think that gets the meaning across much nicer. So jism is a physical object. So you have the physical objects of the universe, and these are constituted by material substances. And there are non-physical objects. So the human soul, according to the Aristotelians, Avicennans, is a non-physical object, doesn't have a location. So qala al-hukama, they said that al-jawhar, he's going to first talk about the jawhar that constitutes a material substance. So he says, al-jawhar, in kana halan fasura, wa in kana mahallan laha fahayula. So you have something called sura, and you have something called hayula. So sura is form. Sura is form. this idea, and Hayula is matter. So it's physical matter, prime matter, Hayul. This hylomorphism comes from this. So this distinction between form and matter, Aristotelian distinction, it went into the physical universe. It went everywhere else as well. So in logic, for example, if you take a syllogism, the syllogism has a form and it has matter. The form of the syllogism is the structure. All A is B, all B is C, therefore all A is C. This is the form of the syllogism. This is called formal logic. And this is something we study today as well. We study formal logic. Formal logic is the study of the structure of reasoning, the form of reasoning, and you abstract away the matter of it, the thing, that the specific terms that constitute it. And so you have the, so if you say, in the same way, Aristotle, he did it there, and he did it over here in the physical universe as well. He said that if I take this cell phone or this misbaha, this misbaha has a form, and you can and that this form is like the form of the syllogism. If there's an abstract form, and then there's the actual matter that makes it into a physical object that's a misbaha. And so all physical objects, Aristotle, he theorized, they are constituted of matter, hayula, and form. And the forms are different, and it's the forms that change, and the hayula stays the same. So both of these, they are substances. So, and this here, when you have neither, the matter and form cannot exist independently, they can only exist together. When they come together, they form a jism. So what's a jism? Jism is a physical object, but it's a composite. Physical object, or you can call it there's some kind of a composition in here. It's a composite physical object. This is a jism. So when the form of the misbaha inheres in the matter, it becomes a physical object called a misbaha. And this is the jism. So this jism is the unity of the matter and the form. And this is what a jism is constituted by. This is important because the mutakallimun, they use the word jauhar in a different meaning, and they use the word jism in a different meaning. The end result is the same. They'll both say that the misbaha is a jism, but the way that they'll break it down physically is going to be very different. The mutakallimun, they have an atomistic theory of the natural world. He says, wa illa, in other words, so he says the jauhar, this was the material substance. The material substance is either matter or form. Then you have an immaterial substance. An immaterial substance is something that it's not physical. It doesn't have a location. It doesn't occupy space. And there are two kinds of immaterial substances. There's something called a nafs, and there's something called aql. So the nafs is the soul. It's like the human soul. So we have the human soul, and the aql is, it's like a it's translated as intellect. So he believed, Aristotle believed in these intellects, or I'm not intellects, and Neoplatonism expanded on those intellects. There's a process of emanation. Aristotelianism, it believes that, it holds that the changes in the universe are necessary, and there's a change is a movement. There's a movement from what Aristotle called potentiality to actuality. So Aristotle would say that you have a seed. A seed is potentially a tree, and this movement from the seed being a seed to a tree, movement from potentiality to actuality, this movement is, there's a chain of these movements. It goes back to an active intellect, which is God, which doesn't have any potentiality. And this chain of ways in which things unfold and realize themselves is necessary. It cannot be otherwise. the mutakallimun, they inherited this, they analyzed it. And this is where, for those of you who studied some kalam, when they talk about tabi'a, he says, for example, in the kharida, where when it says that how does it go? وَمَنْ يَقُلْ بِالْقُوَّةِ الْمُدَعَةِ فَذَاكَ بِدْعِيٌ فَلَا تَلْتَفِتِي وَمَنْ يَقُلْ بِالْطَبْعِ أَوْ بِالْعِلَّةِ فَذَاكَ كُفْرٌ عِنْدَ أَهْلِ الْمِلَّةِ So the one, وَمَنْ يَقُلْ بِالطَبْعِ طَبْعِ is the nature of things. And so the another way to express this potentiality and actuality is to say that the seed has a nature. It's naturally something that turns into a tree. It's not, and you get the four Aristotelian causes, and he explained the universe in this way, and everything goes back to a non-physical intellect that is thinking, and because of its thinking, the world becomes intelligible. It has meaning. We can then grasp it and make sense of it, and there's this necessary unfolding of change in the universe. Now, if you're hearing this for the first time, you're going to say, what's the proof? Where in the world is he getting this from? And it sounds, I'm trying to wrap my mind around it. How exactly does this work? The way that I deal with these things is the way I look at it is it actually doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. And there are holes in it, and it's not based on adequate evidence. But it was something that the people of that time, when the mutakallimun were writing, they took it on wholesale. And this is how they analyzed the world. They took it as something that's a given because they were intellectually awe-inspired by this complexity that they saw. And it's not too much different from the situation that we find ourselves in today, where, if 100 years, if there's 1,000 years left to our universe, if the Day of Judgment doesn't come before then, people will look back to us and they'll say that, these people, they used to believe that the universe came into existence at this event they called the Big Bang that wasn't big and it wasn't a bang. But then they said that there's nothing that made it, because the only thing that exists is physical things. And if only thing that exists is physical things, then there can't be a non-physical thing that made it. And there's E equals MC squared, and there's relativity, and there's quantum gravity, and there's all this complexity. And you look at it and you say, wow. And then people at that time, they'll just say, that's so complex. But how can you make sense of the fact that the universe was not made by anything? And at that time, people will say it doesn't make sense, but people were overawed by all of these technical things. That's why they accepted it. So it's no different than that. So we just need to kind of step back a little bit and understand it at a high level. And our goal when we are understanding falsafa and what the hukama are saying is not to become Aristotelians, but our goal is to understand what the mutakallimun were saying when they were speaking to them. And this is the most important thing for all of us to take away today, that when we see falsafa vocabulary, falsafa, what the hukama says in the books of kalam, the reason why we need to understand falsafa is to understand what the mutakallimun are doing with it, not to take the falsafa and turn it into something that's a part of our theology, because that's very problematic and it's wrong, and they never intended it as such. And I'm going to show you today, I'm going to illustrate why they didn't intend it as such. So This is the breakdown of the substance according to the hukama. What about the mutakallimun? So the mutakallimun, he says, وقال المتكلمون, says over here, وقال المتكلمون لا جوهر إلا المتحيز كما مر. So what he's saying that according to the mutakallimun, there's no such thing as an immaterial substance. That's the first thing that he's going to say. So the mutakallimun, they believe that everything is physical. Everything is physical. Everything apart from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is physical. It has a location, even the human soul. So the human soul, the mutakallimun, to them, it's like a ghost. And a ghost has the shape of it's something that can pass through walls and things like that, but it has a shape and it has a location and it has a where you can point to it. According to the mutakallimun, everything that exists is physical and there is no non-physical thing, contingent thing in existence. The contingent universe is entirely physical, materialists. But the only difference is that we believe that matter is contingent and it depends on a necessary being who's non-physical for it to exist. And so we affirm the existence of God. But otherwise, in terms of the physical universe, the mutakallimun said they're materialists because they negated the existence of anything that's immaterial. They said there's not adequate proof in it. If you read what the mutakallimun say, this is a purely philosophical position. Whether or not there is something that is not mutahayyiz, something that mutahayyiz means that tahayyiz is to have a location. Whether or not anything exists that does not have a location is not a theological point. So we're going to see somewhere, maybe somewhere over here, it says that Imam al-Ghazali, he believed that, like the philosopher, that the human soul does not have a location. Was he accused of holding a position that's theologically unacceptable, of being a mubtadi', for example? He wasn't, because it doesn't go against any point of the Quran or Sunnah to affirm that there is something that does not have a location. But purely on philosophical grounds, on scientific grounds, the mutakallimun said there's no such, everything that exists in the universe apart from God is mutahayyiz, it has a location. And also, purely on philosophical grounds, and this is something that I will illustrate as we go through this lesson, purely on philosophical grounds, not on theological grounds, they said that the universe is constituted not of this matter, prime matter, hayo, and form, but the universe is constituted by atoms. So it's called al-jawhar al-fard. And so this is called kalam atomism. The jawhar al-fard is the indivisible atom. And that they call it kalam atomism. And atomism, I don't like the translation atomism for the same reason as above. So if I had it my way, I wouldn't translate it as a indivisible atom. I would translate it as an indivisible particle, not as an indivisible atom. Why? Because atomism. Atomism is an ancient philosophy. So atomism, there were atomists before Aristotle. So the mutakallimun were not inventors of atomism. They didn't invent the theory of atomism. Atomism, it has a long legacy before Aristotle. And the mutakallimun, they learned from that legacy, they took it, they improved it, they went beyond it, and they argued purely on philosophical grounds that it was a superior theory of the physical universe. It's a better theory of the physical universe than the matter and form hylomorphism that Aristotle presented, and they're going to give arguments for that, and we're going to look at a couple of arguments. So according to the mutakallimun, a jawhar is you have something called jawahir and you have something called a'rab. So the a'rab was the previous lesson. A'rab is a, so you have a contemporary philosophical translation would say that a jawhar is an object, but not just any object, but it's a contingent object. And they went to the mutakallimun, they went to great lengths to show that when they are talking about the jawhar and the arad, then they are talking about the contingent universe, and everything in it is contingent, because this is an important way in which they critiqued the hylomorphism of Aristotle. Aristotle, he and Ibn Sina as well, they didn't believe that the universe is completely contingent, because they believe that the natures of things necessarily bring about their effects. And so the universe cannot be any other way than it is. This makes miracles impossible. It limits the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And they didn't even believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has any power. I think that translating a Jauhar as a contingent object and a Arad, which is the counterpart of the Jauhar, as a contingent property is a... Now philosophers today, they talk about properties and objects. Objects and properties, and the metaphysics, modern metaphysics, these are the terms that will be used. So it helps locate the discussion in a better way in modern philosophy. So that's why I've translated it as you have a contingent object, and this contingent object has properties, and these properties are contingent, and there's various kinds of properties, and these were discussed in the last seminar. So they said la jauhar illa al mutahayyiz, and the way that they, and he says, and there's two kinds of jawahir. They believed that, so you have this word jism, right? This jism was mentioned up here, which I said is a physical object or a composite object. We can use the same translation for jism here. You have a physical object like what? Like my misbaha. So this misbaha is a physical object. And according to the mutakallimun, this is physical object, every bead in this physical object, every part of the bead, you can keep on dividing it, and you come to a point where you reach a particle that is indivisible, the smallest possible particle, indivisible particle. And this particle is called al-jawhar al-farq. And all physical objects are constituted of, they're constituted of of these particles, of these individual particles. So here, the عند الجمهور, الجسم عند الجمهور مجموع الجزئين. So the متكلمون, they differed. Some of them, they said, how many particles do you need to make a jism, to make a physical object? And according to most of them, you only need two. You need two particles to make a jism. Others said four, others said six, others said eight. There's various arguments for that. There's other positions here as well. So Al-Qadi, this is Abu Bakr al-Baqillani, he disagrees on this. We'll see Amidi disagrees on this. Others disagree on this. This is a disagreement amongst the mutakallimun. And if you read the Kalam tradition, they'll say they'll mention the positions of the Mu'tazili atomists on this. Many of the Mu'tazila were also atomists. And they'll say that this disagreement amongst the mutakallimun and the Mu'tazila, it doesn't return to any theological issue. It's just a purely philosophical issue, has no bearing on your theological beliefs. So why then did the mutakallimun advocate atomism, and why did they argue against hylomorphism? That's a question I want us to keep in our minds, and I'll explain it. I'll explain the answer as we continue through this lesson. So the indivisible particle, here it is. It has no form. It has no dimension. It has no again. These are things that are counterintuitive. You can't really imagine them. And but that's not shouldn't be a problem, because many ideas in modern quantum mechanics you also cannot imagine. The conclusions of quantum mechanics are more strongly have more evidence than the conclusions of many of these discussions that we're going to see here. That's another point that I want us to take away from today's session. So this is the first discussion. So if we go back now, we have an idea of what is meant by the Jauhar. So let's go back to page
to the table of contents.
So in the table of contents, he talked about, he said, al-muqaddima fi taqseem al-jawhar. So he talked, he described the various kinds of jawahir according to the philosopher, according to the mutakallimun, and according to the mutakallimun. And now we have an idea of what he's going to talk about. And so he says, al-marsadul awwal. So there's this section, it has three subsections. The first one is fil jism. What's a jism? Remember, a johar is a substance, or it's a substance, or it's an indivisible particle. And it's the thing, the johar is the thing that constitutes the jism. So the jism, the ajsam, are the physical objects, like the misbaha. And what are these, how are these physical objects constituted? According to Aristotelian hylomorphism, they're constituted by matter and form. According to the mutakallimun, they're constituted through the composition of indivisible particles, atoms, kalam atoms. So it says, al-marsadul awwal fil jism wa fihi fusul. So he talks about the first, there's many subsections of this. He talks about the physical objects. He says, what is a jism? He mentions the details of what the mutakallimun say, what the falasifa say, what the definition of a jism. We're going to skip that. He says, laysa al-jismu majmu'a a'radin mujtami'a. This is in contemporary muriology or something, it's a branch of metaphysics. And there are some people who will say there's no such thing as an object and all you have are properties. And so he's saying that there is, the physical objects are not just properties, but you need to have a substance. There's a back and forth there. He says it's non-inferentially known. Others will, there's a challenge to that. A good introductory thing to look at. There's a connection to modern analytic philosophy, but modern analytic philosophy in this area is far, the discussions are far more advanced and developed than in the Kalam tradition. But there's at least something you can hook things onto. He says, "Fi qabul al-jism al-basit lil-qisma." So now what he's going to do here is, there's in the question, from a scientific philosophical level, the difference between the mutakallimun and the falasifa, the Aristotelians, is the answer to this question. Is matter, not matter, are physical objects, ajsam, infinitely divisible? Can I take a bead in this misbaha, divide it into two, and then divide it into two, and then divide it into two, and then divide it into two, and keep on going and 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 going without end? Or am I going to reach a limit that after, when I reach that limit, I can no longer divide it? The philosopher, Aristotelians, hylomorphists, they say it's infinitely divisible. It's divisible without end. The mutakallimun, they say that it's not divisible without end, but you reach a limit. And so a consequence of that, there's in this section, I was going to go through it, but I'm going to leave, you can read it yourself. I'm not going to go through it. He mentions four positions. He actually mentions two questions. Are physical objects infinitely divisible? And that's one thing. And the other thing is, are physical objects constituted of a finite number of parts? And there's four options. And the two most prominent ones are the positions of the mutakallimun and the philosopher. The mutakallimun, they say physical objects are not infinitely divisible, and they are constituted of a finite number of particles. So everything is made up of a finite number of a countable number of indivisible particles. And the philosopher, they say that physical objects are infinitely divisible. You can keep on dividing them without end, and they're not constituted of particles. They're not made up of particles. You just have this prime matter that you're dividing, and you can keep on going. So the physical theory, you have a, so the mutakallimun have a physical theory, and the philosopher have a physical theory. What's their physical theory? Hylomorphism. What's this word? You have hyal. Hyal is the Greek word for matter, and that's where hyula comes from. Morphism is changing, the changing of matter. The changing of matter from one form into another form, into another form, into another form, into another form, kind of reminds you of the, you know, what you learn in chemistry, that matter is neither created nor destroyed, but only changes from one form into another. It's kind of similar. That's like a hylomorphic echo in modern science. And what I'm going to show you as we go through this is that modern science, even though modern science believes in atoms and then subatomic particles, it doesn't get into these kinds of discussions. It's coming at things from a different perspective. So the two physical theories of the, by the way, if you're wondering, you know, what is the theological relevance of all of this, I'm going to, in my opinion, it doesn't have the exact physical theory. It doesn't have any theological relevance. It's not just my opinion. This is actually what you'll see over here too. The actual physical theory does not have any relevance. And it doesn't have any theological relevance, but the reason why the mutakallimun are talking about this is because they need to show that the universe began to exist, that the universe is contingent. And when you talk about the universe and you want to show that it's contingent, and somebody believes that it's constituted of matter and form, or somebody believes that it's constituted of indivisible particles, then you need to show that matter and form are created, or indivisible particles are created. That's what you need to show. And in our times, what do you need to show? You need to show that hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, all of these elements that are in the periodic table, and the particles, you know, electrons, protons, neutrons, and quarks, all of these things, you need to show that these things are created. So the you have to express, what you have to do is you have to express the underlying argument of the mutakallimun in the vocabulary of the physical theory of the time. And when we're looking at this, the value of this is understanding how the mutakallimun expressed their arguments, which have Quranic origins. I explained that in an earlier seminar, how they expressed those things in the language of the natural philosophy of their time. And there's lessons we can take from that. But the actual natural philosophy, it's not something that we're bound to. We're not theologically bound to. And it would be a mistake to simply take it, because even the mutakallimun didn't see themselves as theologically bound to any of these things. And this is very clear in the Mawaqif. I'm going to show you that. But before we go there, there needs to be, we need to go through just this debate very briefly. And so the debate over hylomorphism and atomism, it revolves around the infinite divisibility of matter. And so this comes here in the fourth subsection of this subsection. He says, الرابع في حجة المتكلمين على تركيب الجسم من أجزاء بالفعل متناهن. This means that this is about the proof of the mutakallimin. The proof of the mutakallimin that jism, physical objects, are tarkib, murakkab. They are composed of, they are constituted by ajza bil fi'l. Ajza bil fi'l means actual parts. There are actual particles that constitute physical reality. Because there's infinite divisibility is one thing, and actual constitution by particles is another. So it's an actual constitution by a mutanahin, a finite number of parts. So what are the mutakallimun doing? They are proving that the physical universe is constituted by atoms, a finite number of atoms. Everything in the physical universe is constituted by a finite number of indivisible particles. And and one of the reasons why this is valuable is that it blows the argument of the Aristotelians out of the water. The Aristotelians, they used their hylomorphism to prove that the universe, the changes in the universe are necessary. They could not have been otherwise. So when a seed turns into a sapling, turns into a tree, this change, it's necessary. That's where the laws of nature comes from. So there's an Aristotelian way to depict the laws of nature. And a thoroughgoing Aristotelian depiction of the laws of nature is going to be revolve around the natures of things, and these natures of things being potentialities within objects that necessarily actualized in a particular way that could not have been otherwise, because it's natural necessity. Where does natural necessity come from? It has Aristotelian echoes in it, from the nature of things. So they said that they had this necessity, and because of this necessity, there can't be any resurrection, miracles are not possible. And the other thing that followed from this, their hylomorphism, in the way that they described it, was that the universe did not begin to exist, and that God is not characterized by the attributes of knowledge, will, and power, but he's like an active intellect that cannot choose to do anything, doesn't have knowledge. And these things are all wrapped up in their very complicated natural philosophy. So what do? You come and you say that, well, everything they say is based on the fact that matter is not infinitely divisible. I'm going to prove to you it's based on the fact that matter is infinitely divisible and it's not constituted of particles. I'm going to prove to you that matter is not infinitely divisible and it's composed of a finite number of particles, and the changes that you see are not a result of the prime matter of the universe taking on all of these different forms, but these changes are a result of these particles coming together, and they have these contingent properties, and God is creating these properties, and they're winking in and out of existence, according to one interpretation. There's another interpretation in which they don't wink in and out of existence. And this is how you're going to see the world. And now their entire argument for the necessity of the things in the universe goes away. Their entire argument for the fact that the universe began to exist goes away just in one fell swoop. It's all gone. Okay. It just so happens that philosophically, if you think about it, atomism, the arguments for atomism are stronger than the arguments for hylomorphism, and that's true. If you look at the arguments that the mutakallimun make for the physical universe being constituted by a finite number of atoms, you'll see that and you compare these arguments to the arguments of the Aristotelians, Aristotelian arguments, they're just, at least the way that they present the mutakallimun, they present this here, and the way that they present them, they're just over complex, based on suppositions, and we're going to look at a couple, and it's not really good at all. Now, does that mean that the atomism is really good and conclusive? It doesn't. It doesn't mean that their atomistic arguments are conclusive. In fact, they're not. And I'll show you that now. So let's go into over here. في حجة المتكلمين على تركيب الجسم من أجزاء بالفعل متناهن. This is page 186. Okay, so here you go. في حجة المتكلمين. He says, the متكلمون, what is their proof of the fact that matter is not infinitely divisible and it's constituted of these particles? He says, their proof, there's two kinds of proof. You have the first kind of proof and you have a second kind of proof. To go through all of these proofs, we would be at it for about 10, 15 hours. I don't want to do that. I don't want to torture you. But I'll go through, I'll outline the first kind of proof. You say what's and walk you through one version of it. I'm going to make you, and I'm going to make an observation that that is, I'm going to show you something that you might find surprising. And then I'll move on to something else. So here, so this is the first kind of proof is, how does it go? He says, أَنُّبَيِّنَ أَوَّلًا أَنَّ كُلَّ مُنْقَسِمٍ لَهُ أَجْزَاءٌ بِالْفِعْلِ. So he says that we need to prove two premises. What the first premise is, everything that is divisible is constituted of actual parts. Why are they writing this syllogism in this way? Because this is the way that you need to talk to. This is the way that you need to talk to the interlocutor. لَهُ أَجْزَاءٌ بِالْفِعْلِ. Just a second, Saf, one sec. And the second premise, أَنْ كُلَّ مُقَسِمُ أَجْزَاءٌ بِالْفِعْلِ ثُمَّ نُبَيِّنْ أَنَّهَا مُتَنَاهِيَةٌ. The second thing is to show that those parts are finite. They're not infinite. Everything is constituted of actual parts, and those parts are finite. So, Saf, you have a question? I'll pass it to you. Are you? Was that a mistake? The hand raise? Okay. So I'll keep on going. Whenever you want to talk, you can just chime in, inshallah. Value your thoughts and feedback. So these are the two premises. Okay, so everything that is divisible is constituted of actual parts. Those parts are finite. So then he says, how do we know that everything that is divisible is constituted of actual parts? He says, أَمَّا الْأَوَّلْ فَلِوُجُوهُ. He gives the first reason. He gives another reason. And it's and he gives a third reason. And we can walk through them, but it's just, it's just tortuous. I don't think it's very important, and it's just explaining something that's very obvious, and they're using the terms of their interlocutors at that time, and it's just really obvious. It makes things more complicated than it needs to be. So I'm just going to skip that. Which is just to prove to you that everything that is divisible is constituted of actual parts. Basically, what he's saying is that if I can take anything like this miswak, wow, this is a really Islamic philosophical session. So you take this miswak and you divide it into two, that means that it has two parts. Seems pretty obvious. So, but you have three proofs for that. But I want to look at the second thing here, that those parts are finite. Once you show that everything that is divisible is constituted of actual parts, and to show that those parts are finite. And so let's look at his proofs, right? So he says, وَأَمَّا الثَّانِي, as for the second, which is showing that they are finite, let's look at this. This is first proof, الأول. The first proof is like this, okay? لَوْ كَانَتْ الْمَسَافَةَ مُرَكَّبَةً مِنْ أَجْزَاءٍ غَيْرْ مُتَنَاهِيَةً. Let's say you have a distance. You have a distance. And let's say that this is a distance of 5 meters. Okay, and you want to cross this distance. And let's say it's composed of an infinite number of parts. So you have a runner. You have somebody who wants to traverse this distance. He starts over here and he wants to traverse this distance and he wants to get here. So he says that, and this distance, the ground is a physical object. And so it's composed of a finite number of physical particles. Say, let's assume, this is, we call this reductio ad absurdum, proof by contradiction. Let's assume that there's an infinite number of parts. What happens? It says, لَمْ تَنَعَ قَطْعُهَا فِي زَمَانٍ مُتَنَاهٍ. If it's composed of an infinite number of parts, you cannot traverse this distance in a finite amount of time. Does anybody know? Can anybody see? Does this sound familiar? Do you know what is this? What's this? Does this argument sound familiar to anybody? Have you seen this argument anywhere? What's this argument called? Yeah, this is Zeno's paradox. It's Zeno's paradox. So you can Google Zeno's paradox, which is he said that if there's infinite divisibility, in order to traverse this distance, you have to traverse half the distance. But in order to traverse that, you have to traverse half of that. In order to traverse that, you have to traverse half of that. Half of that, half of that, half of that, you keep on going. And that means you can never traverse anything. Okay, this is Zeno's paradoxes. And this is all of the problems of infinity, modern philosophical problems, they go back to Zeno. And so he's saying that if it was infinitely divisible, it would mean that you cannot cross this in a finite amount of time. Therefore, it's composed of a finite number of parts. And there's other things that are modifications of that. There's other arguments. But this is the thing that I want you to take away is this is not new. This isn't new. The argument for atomism isn't something that the mutakallimun invented. It existed before them. And they are taking another physical theory and they're taking these arguments and they are applying them, they're developing them in their own way. They go through this and he goes through all of these arguments. There's the second kind of argument and there's all of these pages of these arguments. He talks about motion, he talks about all of these things. And then right at the end, after all of this, E.G. has this line. He said, I've given you all of these proofs. He says, وَنَقْلُ ذَلِكَ وَإِنْ كَانَ يُمْكِنُ الْجَوَابُ عَنْهُ جَدَلًا فَفِيهِ لِلْمُنْصِفِ إِقْنَعُ. He said that all of these things, you can do naqd of them. You can take apart, this is a term of a bahth wal munadara, that you can take all of these arguments apart. And you can take all of these arguments apart, there's objections to all of these arguments, and you can respond to all of those objections. But in what I've said, I've given you two arguments. Each for each argument, I've given you five different ways of looking at it. If you're fair, if you're munsif, if you're fair-minded, this is enough for you to see that the universe is constituted by a finite number of particles. This is enough for you. And there's a, so this is the Mawaqif of Adl al-Din al-Iji. It has a commentary by Jurjani, and has a hashiya by Si al-Koti, famous late mutakallim. And in the hashiya, he says that, well, actually, that's not the case. And these arguments, they don't even give you one, let alone tuma'nina or yaqeen. In other words, they don't even give you confidence, let alone certainty. So, in other words, these arguments are not conclusive. And this is widely observed in the Kalam tradition. Taftazani, in his Sharh al-Aqaid al-Nasafiya, the most important Kalam work written in the history of Kalam, he observes, he says that it's not conclusive. And he says the arguments of the other side are not conclusive either. So there's whether, in other words, he's saying that whether the universe is constituted of a finite number of indivisible particles, or whether it's infinitely divisible, the arguments for either one are inconclusive. They're inconclusive. And these are mutakallims. These are real mutakallims because they're fair. There's no asabiyah, there's no bigotry, that's what they observed. And so now I want you to put that in your mind, and I want to observe one more thing over here, and then we need to take a break. Maghrib came in, I'm going to pray Maghrib and then we'll continue. But there's an important, atomism has a long history. There's ancient atomism and there's modern atomism. So there's the development of the modern atomic theory, Dalton's laws and other laws of chemistry and physics, and certain important experiments. They led scientists to the conclusion that of the particulate theory of matter, matter is constituted by particles, atoms, revolutionary discovery, changed modern science. And we now believe that the universe is constituted of these particles, but are they indivisible or not? They're not indivisible. Okay? They're particles. Right? They're particles. The universe is constituted of particles. But what's the evidence for this? What's the evidence? The evidence is completely different than the evidence that the mutakallimun used. This evidence is empirical evidence. It's based on observation. It's based on the observation when you take two gases and they react and you measure their volumes and you look at the proportions of the volumes, and then you take those same gases and you look at the proportions of the volumes, it seems to suggest you can see that they're constituted of particles. That's why, and you can work out the volume that a particular chemical volume of gas that a particular chemical reaction will give. And there's many other lines of empirical reasoning. And so scientific reasoning is not based on philosophical arguments for the infinite divisibility or lack thereof. It's based on experiment, observation, and another kind of reasoning that we call inference to the best explanation. There's discoveries in modern science that have rendered these arguments, they've rendered these arguments, they're not, you can't use these arguments anymore. Why? Because in what we now believe is that our everyday experience of reality, the way that we experience the world, this misbaha or this miswak or something, the way that we experience the world at this level, this experience doesn't carry over to the way that the universe works at the quantum level. The way the universe works at the quantum level is completely counterintuitive. It's it's you cannot extrapolate down. And that's what we're concerned with. But just as an aside, the way that the universe works at large scales, at high speeds, approaching the speed of light because of the theory of relativity, is also completely counterintuitive. Right? These scientific conclusions are subject to change. They're subject to change, but at the moment, they're subject to change in the sense that, you know, we're still discovering more and we're revising. But at the moment, we have a high level of confidence that this is actually the case. And if this is what we believe, if somebody believes this based on the current scientific understanding, that when you divide, you reach a point where the way that the division works and the results of that division are not the same as taking a knife and cutting something in two, then it means you cannot use this argument. You can't use this argument. Something completely different happens at a atomic scale, at a subatomic scale, and that's what we currently believe. So if somebody wanted to ask these questions, they would be very interesting philosophical questions to investigate. And you can do that, but you have to bring in the observations of modern science, and you can't just say that modern science is, you know, there. You can't. You cannot. It's just wrong to dismiss modern science because somebody comes and reads in the books of the Mutakallimun that they analyze the universe in a different way. It's not right, and there's evidence that's being ignored, and most of the people who ignore this evidence, they don't understand it, you know. So this is the first thing. So what I've set up is the difference between the physical theory of the Mutakallimun and the falasifa, Kalam atomism and hylomorphism, and some of the arguments that they used, and they're all around infinite divisibility or lack thereof. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at how the Mutakallimun analyzed what the falasifa said. And that's really fascinating. But I'm going to take I need to pray Maghrib. So let's take a 10-minute break and then continue. In the meantime, if you have any questions, you can inshallah type them, inshallah. So 10-minute break. And Harun, if he wants to add something, or in the meantime, you can do that, inshallah. I'll just be back.
Inshallah, we'll break because afterwards I'll add a few points and then we'll turn to the Q&A. I suppose for those of us who aren't ready for a break, we have the chat box, which I think everybody can access and discuss there. And then if people wanted to carry on a discussion, and also there's the Q&A box, which is the primary place. All questions to Sheikh Hamza should go in the Q&A box. But if people wanted to discuss in the chat, that's possible. I don't really know, I'm not sure how to grant speaking access, but if people wanted to carry out an audio conversation right now during the break, just let me know and I can mess around with this and see if we can have a regular kind of Zoom discussion in the break. So let me know. I'll watch the chat and the Q&A, but otherwise we'll wait till Sidi Hamza comes back.
Assalamu alaikum. So let's continue. Okay, so let's go back and I'll walk you through the so what did we just do? So this is the first, he's talking about the jism, physical object, composite object. And we saw that there's a distinction, there's disagreement between the mutakallimun and the falasifa on the disagreement between them can be returned to whether or not matter is infinitely divisible. We saw the proofs of the mutakallimun about that physical objects are constituted of a finite number of particles. Then he mentions here the arguments of the hukama. For the opposite, the arguments of the philosopher for the fact that matter is infinitely divisible, and they're going to argue that the mutakallimun are mistaken and that matter cannot be constituted of a finite number of particles. He's going to mention their arguments and then he's going to poke holes in their arguments. And that's what he generally does. What he generally does, he's mentioned their arguments, he pokes holes in them. And here's their argument for the existence of a matter and form, which is the competing theory of atomism, a competing theory to atomism. I'm not going to walk through the arguments. What I want to do is I'm going to look at a couple of these. الثامن في تفريعات للحكماء على الهيولة. So once you've established using their philosophical arguments the existence of the hayula and the existence of the sura, there are consequences to that. There's consequences. There's things that you can build on the hayula, on the existence of the hayula, based on the arguments that they made. I think I'm only going to have time for one, and it's a very interesting one. Okay, so there's tafri'at. He mentions a number of them. The first one is that once you establish the hayula, the prime matter, this is an argument for the fact that every physical object is made up of this prime matter. He mentions an argument, and he makes the argument, and then what the mutakallimun they do is they you have a qulna here. There's a jawab there. I'm not going to go through this. He says the second thing that he's going to prove is that the prime matter has to have a form. There's no such thing as matter without form, and he gives various arguments for that. And each one of these, he mentions their argument and he mentions why it's lacking. He mentions a second argument and then why some of the problems with it. He mentions a third argument and some of the problems with it. Just two actually. Then here's the third, the three, that form needs to have matter. You can't have form without matter. He mentions some arguments for that and then he pokes holes in them. He mentions the fourth one, fifth. Here's the fourth one. It's a bit complicated. It's related to what we just did. So here's a fifth one. I want to get to the sixth one. This is very interesting. Okay. So he says, سادسها كل جسم له حيز طبيعي. Every jism, every physical object has a natural location. In order to understand what's happening, we need to put this into context. So Aristotle believed that the natural state of things is that they are at rest. And if they move, so if you have something that's moving, there's a force that needs to act upon it to keep it moving. And if you take away the force, it'll stop. So if an object is moving, it's being acted upon by a force, and then it'll stop. It's actually, it's not, the accurate thing is not that it's going to stop, but it's going to go to its natural, it's going to return to its natural place, natural location. And the natural place is like the center of the universe, and the earth is at the center of the universe. So when he says that every physical object has a natural location that it tends towards, this was the dominant view of dominant scientific view for in Western Europe for 2,000 years since Aristotle until Newton. When he formulated his laws of motion, so one of his laws is that every object shall remain in motion or in a state of rest until acted upon by an external force. So what we now believe, and based on scientific evidence, is that if something is moving, it stays moving. It stays moving in a straight line. Still moving in a straight line. And to stop it, you need a force. And then to make it move, you need a force. And when Newton formulated this theory, Galileo, he formed his theory for the, he proposed his theory that it's not the earth that's the center of the universe, but it's the earth goes around the sun. So instead of geocentrism, heliocentrism, there's a couple of other things. Galileo, like the famous experiment of Leaning Tower of Pisa, whether or not it happened, that's debatable, historically debatable. But the general idea that Aristotle believed that heavy objects fall faster than lighter objects, his theory of sight, he said that when you see something, there's a ray that comes out of your eyes and it hits the object, whereas now we believe that it's light coming into the eye, not something coming out of the eye. And there's a couple of other key Aristotelian scientific conclusions that, you know, modern science rose in reaction to these. So Aristotle's physics, generally speaking, Aristotle, he's great, really good in his logic. His biology was pretty good too. A lot of other things, very, you know, his ethics is, you know, it's, we can use a lot of it. We took it and we Islamized it. We have our own ilmul akhlaq. But his physics, his natural philosophy physics, is the one that it's that branch of his learning, of his corpus, that has taken the greatest critique, and it's been critiqued the most in the development of the modern world. And modern science developed in conflict with this Aristotelianism that was dogmatically assumed by the church. So one of these things is a classic Aristotelian mistake. When Al-Iji is mentioning this, he's mentioning this as a position of the philosopher. Of the philosopher. So he's saying Sadisuha, the sixth tafriya of the philosopher, the sixth extrapolation of the philosopher on the argument for the existence of prime matter is that every physical object has a natural location. Darurata, because of the necessity that annahu law khulliya wa tab'ahu lakana lahu makanun daruratan. He says that if it were left to its own, with its own nature, it would come and settle in some place.
And that's its natural place. Qulna, this is E.G. Mamnua. Mamnua. He says, Qulna Mamnua. There's a number of things that come out of this. So he the first thing he says, he challenges this. He challenges this fact, this idea that that a physical object has a natural location, and he challenges it on two grounds. The first ground is an internal inconsistency within the Aristotelian natural philosophy itself. He says that there is something else called al-muhaddad or muhaddid. This is the outermost celestial sphere. I'll describe the celestial spheres shortly, inshallah. Which he says doesn't have a location, and so I'm not well versed enough in the natural philosophy of Avicenna, of the Aristotelians, to explain exactly how this argument is going. But at a high level, what's happening is he's saying that it's not admissible to say that every physical object, when it's left to itself, it comes to a particular location, because there is a counterexample, according to you yourself, of a particular kind of physical object that doesn't do that. So he's saying there's an internal inconsistency. He says, أو تكون نسبته إلى الأحياز سواء حتى يخصصه المختار. أو تكون نسبته إلى الأحياز سواء حتى يخصصه المختار. ولو فرضت الأحياز خالية ثم خلق الأرض كان نسبتها إلى الأحياز كلها سواء. إذ ليس ثمة مركز ولا محيط كما قال ثابت بن قرة. And he goes on, and he says that the location that a physical object has doesn't come about as a result of its nature, but the location that it assumes, it comes about as a result of the choice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of the choice of God, who is al-fa'il al-mukhtar, who is a volitional agent, who has selected for it the place that it occupies. So this objection is very interesting. The reason why it's interesting is that this is not an empirical objection. He's saying the philosopher, they said that every object, if it's left on its own, it will come to occupy a natural place. It has a natural location, it will come to occupy it. And the objection is that this conclusion that you're coming to, based on your observation that if you leave everything, it comes to its place, this conclusion, you're making an assumption. And the assumption that you're making is that it's naturally, لَوْ خُلِّيَّ وَطَبْعَهُ, it's left to its own natural potentiality, and it's this natural potentiality that is moving it to occupy its natural place. He's saying that that's not what's happening, because the necessity that comes along with the Aristotelian hylomorphism of things naturally moving from potentialities to actualities to another actuality, this necessary movement of cause and effect, this view of reality is mistaken. Actually, what's the case is that the things in the universe are contingent, and it's possible for them to have this location, and it's possible for them to have another location. And the fact that they have a particular location is a result not of their nature, but of the selection, of the choice, of the volitional agency, of the necessary being on whom they depend. So this is a theological critique. It's a theological critique. He's saying that your scientific conclusion is based on a metaphysical assumption that is mistaken, because the world is not a chain of natural necessities, cause and effects, but it's the action of a volitional agent, a necessary being on whom everything depends. This shows us a number of things. The first thing, so this it comes up in a number of other critiques as well. You'll see, as if you follow carefully, how he says, okay, the Aristotelians, they argued that the physical world has to work like this because it's the nature of things to be this way. And it must work like this because it's the nature of things to be this way. And it must work like this because it's the nature of things to be this way. You see this kind of tendency in their arguments, and you see the critique. And what's the critique? The critique is that it's not the nature of things. It's these things are contingent and they rely on a necessary being who's a volitional agent. These are, I'll do this inshallah next week when we cover when we cover arguments for God inshallah. But he's critiquing their hylomorphism, and this critique of hylomorphism is not based on atomism. You don't need to prove that the universe is composed of a finite number of indivisible particles to disprove the fact that that there's a natural necessity in the universe. You don't need to do that. You can do it without adopting the physical theory of atomism. It's possible. Atomism is not required to critique the mistaken elements of hylomorphism. This is one thing a thing that I want you to keep in mind. The second thing I want you to keep in mind is that the classical critique of modern science against Aristotelian physics is that Aristotle, he reached conclusions regarding how things should behave on insufficient observation. And he rushed to conclusions because he believed that it was part of the natures of things to behave a particular way. And when we then, later on, our ability to observe the universe increased, we are able to, through empirical observation, come to a conclusion that's better than simply relying on the natures of things. Now, Aristotelians, they will challenge whether or not this is really the case, particularly Thomists. There's Muslims who will be on the sides of the Thomists. I don't want to get into that. I don't think it's relevant. But the only thing that I want you to see is that the popular way in which Aristotle is critiqued is that he's not scientific enough because he doesn't use empirical reasoning. Because why? Because he has an assumption. What's the assumption? The assumption is that the way that things work in the universe is because of the natures of things. And if you can grasp the natures of things, you can come to conclusions about how the universe behaves. And the scientist says, no, don't do that. Get rid of the natures of things. Get rid of the natures of things. Get rid of final causation. Get rid of teleology. This is where science is coming from. When modern science, it says that get rid of final causes, get rid of teleology. Why are they doing this? This is why they're doing this. They're saying, don't do this. Be empirical. Be empirical. It's not about the natures of things. Just use your observation and come to a conclusion about how the universe behaves. And that's how you do science. That's how you do science. Now, look at what the mutakallimun are doing. The mutakallimun are also critiquing. They're also critiquing reaching conclusions about how the universe behaves based on the natures of things. But how are they critiquing it? They're critiquing it philosophically. They're saying that the universe is contingent, and the contingency of the universe means that things are made the way they are by the necessary being who's a fa'il mukhtar, not by the natures of things. And when they do that, they are freeing our minds from the assumptions of Aristotelianism that were the obstacles in the progress of modern science. This is profound. This goes through, if you follow what they're saying, this comes in again and again and again and again. This is really profound. And so when Newton's discovery in a Muslim context would not ruffle any feathers. I'm going to show you shortly, we're going to look at geocentrism, we're going to see that Galileo's discovery would also not ruffle any feathers. So keep this in mind. This is really important, and it can be applied to modern science as well. I'm going to walk you through this and just do one more thing, and then I'll close, inshallah. So I won't go over time, but I just want to walk you through this. So what does he do next? He says that he talks after talking about the natural philosophy of the mutakallimun and the falasifa. He says al-faslu thani fi aqsam al-jism, on the kinds of physical objects. Now, I want you to look at the kinds of physical objects that he mentioned. What are they? Aflak. What are aflak? These are celestial spheres. What are celestial spheres? Celestial spheres are Aristotle, and for 2,000 years after him, people, including the Muslims, this is found in our books of tafsir, when we talk about aflak, the falak, and in Baydawi, this was the way that everybody viewed the world. When you look at the heavens, you see the stars are moving. There's a circular motion. And it's the same circular motion. So they said that these are little tiny points, and they're embedded in spheres. And these spheres are rotating. And it's through the rotation of these spheres that we get these movements of the stars. So you have the movements of the stars, and then the moon is not in that same sphere because it doesn't move like the stars move. So it's in its own sphere. And the planets, they don't move like those stars do because they're actually orbiting around the Earth and so have these erratic movements. So they have their own sphere, and the sun has its own sphere, and in the middle, there's the Earth. This is a geocentric view of the universe, with the Earth is the center of the universe. The Earth is the center of the universe. And when you look up at the sky, you see all of these things moving around the Earth, and their movements are understood as movements of various spheres. And some of the scholars of tafsir, they identified these seven spheres with the seven heavens. But then there's a problem, because the falasifa, they actually held there to be nine heavens, nine aflak, nine spheres. And there's others that held different kinds of numbers. So he goes through what these spheres are. You have the muhaddid or muhaddad. This is the outermost sphere. Then you have the thawabit. These are the stars that don't move that much. You have the sphere of the sun, of the moon, and the remaining spheres. So this is all I want you to... He's going to mention these spheres. But what is he going to do? He's going to mention them, and he's going to mention why the evidence for it is not conclusive. Whenever he mentions any of these conclusions of the physics of the Aristotelians, he'll mention their argument. What's their argument based on? It's based on their hylomorphic theory of the universe, their limited observations, and these natures of things, and the natural necessity, and they'll come to these conclusions. And again and again, the natural necessity will be critiqued, and they'll say, well, it could be like this, it could be like this, why don't you say it's like this? It's all, he's taking the dominant science of the time, and he's saying it's not conclusive. So now, this is, he's mentioning this, what is, he's educating people in the science of the time. He's educating them in their arguments. He's teaching them how our own philosophy, our own theology integrates with those arguments. He's saying they're not conclusive, and he's leaving it. And he's leaving the door open. He's leaving the door open for a new philosophy of nature, which is what modern science is. Modern science is a new philosophy of nature based on superior observations to come about and describe the universe in a different way. And all of these things can be updated, because his whole thing is to show that they're not conclusive. And Imam al-Ghazali said that in the Tahafut. If you read his Tahafut, he just is inconclusive. Most of their conclusions regarding the natural world are inconclusive, but people nevertheless believed in them for a long time. And so they're analyzed here. Right? So this is also very interesting. So Kalam, it freed the mind of the scientists. That's why many of the Muslim scientists, they were able to make discoveries that went against the conclusions of Aristotle, because the Mutakallimun had paved the way and said that he's not religiously sacred like the Christians did to him. So you have the Aflak, okay? you have the celestial spheres. Then you have the Kawakib. What are the Kawakib? The Kawakib are these are the things, the celestial objects that are embedded in these spheres as they move. And so the moon is a kawkab. The planets are kawakib. He describes the eclipse of the sun and moon according to this science. The phases of the moon, I'm not sure. Majarra now is a galaxy. I'm not sure what it is now. He describes all of these things. You can look at them. But again, what I want you to see is, now that you have a high level overview of what he's doing, you can understand how to benefit from it now. The details of these arguments, they're no longer relevant. They're no, because this is not how we look at the universe. We look at the universe in a completely different way. We have a different kind of reasoning. We have different lines of evidence for figuring out what exists in the natural world. And so all of this can be updated, can be removed. And there is the door is open for us to do that. Then he talks about the anasir. What are the anasir? The anasir are the four elements. So Aristotle, he believed that, it wasn't Aristotle, he actually inherited it from some of the pre-Socratics, that everything in this earthly sphere is made up of four elements, which are there's earth, water, air, and fire, and they get progressively lighter. So earth is the densest, it goes to the bottom of water, and then water goes to the bottom and air comes up, and fire is higher. So they have this natural kind of movement. Everything is made of these four things. And this is what people believed for a long time. And if you read here, it's very, it's an interesting discussion, because it's not conclusive. It could be something else. Why can't there just be one element? Why can't there just be two elements? He says, and he gives all of these other options. All of these have been replaced by the periodic table of elements. And although the idea of the periodic table of elements is not something that would come to the minds of the Mutakallimun, but they left the door open for that to happen. He talks about the anasir. The anasir are the four elements from which the things in the earthly realm are made of. They had a fifth element, which is ether, which was the element in which in the sky, in the heavens. And people held on to this belief in ether until the beginning of, until the 20th century. It was only that it was refuted. So you read Mustafa Sabri, he'll talk about ether up to his time. He said, so these anasir, he talks about the earth. He talks about whether the earth is round. But I want to look at this. Al-Rabi'ah, fourth discussion. Al-Ardu fi wasat al-kul. The earth is in the middle of everything. This is geocentrism. This is the most important position, this is the defining disagreement between modern science and Aristotle and the Catholic Church with Galileo, Copernicus, the defining thing in the scientific revolution. And so let's see what Al-Iji said about this. Let's go here. There you go. This is the last thing I'm going to do. Then I'm going to go through quickly the table of contents and I'll take your questions, inshallah. It says, Al-Maqsad al-Rabi' al-Ardu fi wasat al-Kul li'anna al-Kawakib fi jami' al-Jihad. So he says, this is what they say. This is what they say. It's a counter-argument. So the philosopher said that al-ardu fi wasat al-kul, the earth is in the middle of everything, in the middle of all of the kawakib, in the middle of all of the celestial spheres. It is the middle of the universe. Everything goes around the earth. Why did they say this? What's their argument? Is their argument that the earth has to be the center of the universe because man is the most important creature, and if he is removed from the center of the universe, he's no longer important, as is related from the belief of the Catholic Church when it embraced Aristotelianism, and the echoes of this are felt down to this day. I have an episode that I recently did in my weekly live stream on Can Muslims Believe in Extraterrestrials? And this discussion goes back to this thing. This is a defining issue. None of that is present. It's not there in our intellectual history. Al-ardu fi wasat al-kul. Why? لِأَنَّ الْكَوَاكِبْ في جميع الجهات, because the celestial bodies, the celestial objects are in all directions. ترى بقدر واحد لا تفاوت فيه. He's saying that when you look at the planets and the stars and the moon, and you know, all of those things are the same thing. We now say planets because we believe in the solar system, but from his perspective, they're all things going around the earth. He says, when you look at them, they look like they're the same. They look like they're the same. They say that if the earth was moving, then their positions would change, their sizes would change. This is something called a parallax. So he's saying, what he's saying here is there would be a parallax. A parallax is when we use this in modern astronomy to measure the distances of stars. What you do is, using precise astronomical observations, you find the location of a star when the earth is on one side of its orbit around the sun. And then it goes onto the other side of the orbit around the sun and you find its distance. And then it's a simple trigonometry problem because you know the radius of the earth's orbit around the sun. You know the distance on these two dates, and you make a triangle using the star whose locations are different, and you use it to work out the distance of the star from the earth. And that's what he's saying here. And Aristotle said this. It's not something Avicenna made up. He said that if the earth was not at the center of the universe, but it actually moved relative to these things that are far away, then you would observe a parallax. But we don't observe a parallax. And that means that the earth is at the center of the universe. Look at what Al-Iji says. Wanaqul, Iji says, Lima la. This is all of these objections, they're written in the language of ilm al-bahthi wal-munadhara, critiquing an argument. Says he is not, this is called al-mana'. You're saying that one of the premises of his argument is not conclusive. You're saying lima la yajuzu an yakuna khurujuha 'an al-wasat biqadrin la yakunu at-tafawut al-mujib lahu mahsusan. He says that why can't it be that the Earth is not at the center of the universe, but it actually, it moves. It has a different, it has a different location other than the center. So actually what he's saying is not that the Earth is moving, but if it's away from the center, then the position of the, you will be able to tell from the position of the stars and the planets. So he's saying that what if it's just the distance with which it departs from the center of the universe is not large enough to create a parallax that is perceptible to the human eye. This is really amazing because what he's saying is that don't take Aristotle for granted. Don't just accept it because it's Aristotle. But think critically. And this argument is based on the fact that the stars are close enough to the Earth for a discrepancy in their location to be manifest to the naked eye if the Earth was not at the center. But maybe it's not at the center, and they're so far away relative to the Earth's not being at the center of the universe that their parallax cannot be detected. And that's, you know, this is an accurate statement. This is an accurate statement. So what's the lesson here? Right? What's the lesson here is, like, this shows is that what did Kalam do? What Kalam did was it removed the assumptions of Aristotelianism. It freed the mind to conduct a rational inquiry, so that if Galileo had appeared in the Muslim world, if Newton had appeared in the Muslim world, they would have had absolutely no problem adopting their conclusions, because they're already thinking along the same lines, and they're saying that these arguments are inconclusive. And empirical observations are great. They give knowledge. Empirical observations give knowledge, right? So they give a tremendous amount of knowledge. And if it weren't for that, you wouldn't be here talking to me and listening to what I have to say from the other side of the planet. So I'm just going to finish up, but he does the same thing now with the other, he talks about the Anasir. He talks about how mountains are made. You know, again, this is going to be pre-modern science. He's going to present the positions of the philosopher and say that they're not conclusive. He's going to talk about the Nufus and the Uqul and the celestial spheres and the kinds of soul. The vegetative soul, the animal soul, the human soul. This is useful. This is actually very useful. It comes out in the Fuqaha use this to this day. They'll analyze the concept of human life, issues of abortion. You'll see these terms used. They're important to understand. These are all based on Aristotle's physics and the way that he divided the universe. He does that, and then he talks about Awaridul Ajsam. This is important, because over here he actually constructs the argument for the fact that the universe is finite in time, and he says that al-maqsul awwal fi anna al-ajsam muhdatha. And I thought that I would have enough time to go through a couple of these arguments, but apparently I don't. So I'm this is where, you know, the modern Kalam cosmological argument, it would come from. It would take its motivation from here, although William Lane Craig is not familiar with all of these arguments that are mentioned here, and he only takes from Ghazali and how he's represented in English by English language scholars of his arguments. There's a lot more here that we can take from. And he mentions a couple of other things. This is interesting too. قال الحكماء لا علم غير هذا العالم. The hukama, the philosopher, said that there is no other universe except for this universe.
and they do it. There's no other universe, and they do it based on their natural philosophy. There can't be more than four elements. And again, the back and forth is very interesting. Say, why can't there be another universe? Why can't Mercury be made of the same elements that Earth is made of? Why can't? And very, very fascinating critiques. And then he talks about the soul and the intellect, the active intellect on that Aristotle believed in was part of his physics. And that's the section on Ajsam. So that was an overview of this section, and I think I'll stop here. But just to recap, the general idea that I want to convey is that these discussions, they're part of an engagement with the philosophy and the science of that time, and it's important for us to distinguish between discussions that are philosophical and scientific that don't have any bearing on our theological commitments, and those that do have a bearing on our theological commitments. And a lot of these things don't. And the critique of the Mutakallimun in all of these things, it's theological. And basically, the only thing that you need to do for what the philosopher did, and that's what Ghazali did in his Tahafut, is you have to prove the absolute contingency of everything that exists. There's no natural necessity, and the universe, it came into existence, and there's a fa'il muhtar, there's a volitional agent on whom the universe depends, who can resurrect us and bring us to judgment. And if you do that, then you're home free. And the Kalam atomism was a rival physical theory that was convenient, but it wasn't conclusive, and it's not necessary. And when you look at the way that the Mutakallimun critiqued the natural philosophy of the Aristotelians, it's very nice, because it shows you that all of the science-religion conflicts that are that have affected the way that modern science has arisen in the Western world, none of them would have happened in the Muslim world. So I'll stop here. Wassallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam.
Jazakumullahu khairan. Thanks so much, Sheikh Hamza. I'll just say a few things, and then we can turn it over to the Q&A. Inshallah, thank you for everyone who's been here so long and stuck with us. Just a few quick points. I think the point on terminology that that Sheikh Hamza mentioned earlier is extremely important. This is something that we're discussing a lot at ACIPT, the American Society of Islamic Philosophy and Theology. And you know, we're discussing how do we, you know, can we collectively come up with some best practices and translations for technical terms from the Arabic into English, given that when we read these so many different translations and academic articles on these subjects, there's not really an agreement on the best translation. So sometimes there's a lot of neologisms that come up with each translator or author. So what I've found personally is, regardless of whether we take a popular English language term, you know, whether it's contingent objects or whether it's substances or whatever it may be, that we constantly remind ourselves of the technical definitions of these terms according to those who are using them, right? So Johar becomes complicated if the conversation is between the philosophers and the Mutakallimin, because one has to constantly remind oneself that they're using the term, they're using the same term in different ways. The Mutakallimin are taking these terms and then redefining them, and so that can get lost sometimes when one is first studying these subjects, and as you get sort of lost in the commentaries and the super commentaries, sometimes one forgets. So one has to constantly remind oneself of the technical meanings, the actual, you know, logical definitions of the terms, or technical definitions of the terms. And also continually connect that to the ontology of the interlocutor, right? So what, you know, with the philosophers, there's a different belief in what exists and its relationship to God, basically. So, and with that, I think these terms like Aristotelianism, Avicennianism, Thomism, we have to remember that they're not interchangeable, that Aristotelianism is not Avicennianism and Avicennianism is not Thomism, right? That each of these three categories have a lot of overlap, but also a lot of important difference, just as presumably Aristotle is, borrowing from the pre-Socratics, but they're not, the pre-Socratics are not Aristotelian in that sense either, presumably. I don't, that's not within my area of expertise. So anyway, just one of the important things that has come up in the lecture today, as well as in our discussions at ACIPT, is really the importance of how are we using these terms. And the reality is we all get tripped up quite often. Whenever we switch to the English language translations, it happens very, very frequently. That we sometimes are speaking across, or past each other because we're using the terms in slightly different ways. And this is a common thing in all discussions and high level discussions and so on. The second thing I wanted to mention briefly, Sidi Hamza, if you don't mind letting me share my screen.
Go ahead.
Okay. Okay, one second. Let me just. Okay. So can you all see this PowerPoint?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So just, as Sidi Hamza was talking, I took one of my notes and just threw it into some stuff that was handwritten and just threw it into a PowerPoint very clearly. I think just to summarize some of what Sidi Hamza was mentioning at the beginning, I think it's important when we're using the term Johar to describe the system of the philosophers, whoever we, Aristotelians or Avicennians or however we define them, that in general, that Johar is each of these five terms of form, hayula, body or object, nefs, soul, and intellect. Are all considered jawahir, right? These are the five jawahir, and to create a jism, one puts the hayula and the jism. So you put the surah and the hayula together equals a jism, right? Yeah, right. And so that's the sort of concept of these five jawahir. If we take that, this sort of quick system, we have to keep in mind. That they, as Sheikh Hamza mentioned, that the Jawahir are either material or immaterial, right? And that these three are in the material category and these two are in the immaterial category. And correct me if I'm wrong, this is quickly thrown together from my notes, but this is what I recall. This is based also on Sheikh Abdul Karim al-Mudarris's summary of this material. And furthermore, we have to remember that this chapter on the Jawahir is connected to last week's or last time's presentation on the A'rad, the contingent properties. And these two categories fall under the category of the Mumkin al-Khas, right? And so, at least in the Avicennian system, as I'm learning it through the writings of Sheikh Abdul Karim al-Mudarris's text on the Maqalat fil Maqulat, these all of this is falling under this category of the possible, right? And that these in relation to the necessary being. So I bring that up because I think it's important somewhere along the line, not necessarily today, to relate the sort of necessity of nature to this concept, right? That you were mentioning. And I don't have an answer to it, and I don't have a position, and I'm not implying one thing or the other. I'm just, these are the more in the form of a question that given that these are from the, all of this is from the realm of the possible, and therefore dependent on the, in some, in a different sort of emanative sense, on the necessary being. Where does the necessity of nature come in?
This is really useful. Can I jump in?
Sure. Please.
Yeah. So basically, what's happening is that when you place, when you put this thing al-mumkin al-khas at the top, and then you say you have arad and johar, and then underneath johar you have all of this, the entire hylomorphic system. What you're doing is you're getting rid of any kind of reasoning in the Aristotelian natural philosophy that is based on natural necessities. You're saying that it doesn't have to be that way. But it doesn't have to be that way doesn't negate the fact that it could be that way. So, but there's other possibilities too. So you're flattening it you're flattening it by removing necessity. You're saying it could be this way, it could be that way. And you're saying that the proof is inconclusive. And then you're leaving it open for people to, so if for people to come along with other proofs, other arguments to either resurrect this or argue for another philosophical system, another natural philosophical system. And so one of the things that would be open is, you know, empirical reasoning can come in, and you can say that, well, it's not empirically necessary, but based on our observations in this experiment that we did, it appears that it's actually, there is a surah in Hayula and it's becoming a jism. That's, it's leaving it open. So that's what's, does that make sense or?
I think so. I guess the question is, you know, is the Thomist sort of narration, this I think is more, this is Avicennian and it's completely devoid of reference to Thomism. So, and because so many of these kind of conversations about the continued validity of the Jauhar and the Arad system are tied to discussions of, you know, a Thomist Catholic arguments against many of the philosophical underpinnings of modern science. The question then is, and this kind of returns to my earlier point about Aristotelianism, Avicennianism, and Thomism, you know, are we, these are possibly three distinct categories, arguably, to my mind, distinct in the sense that there's enough that's different about them that we can't lump them all under Aristotelianism, rather that's a taqseem, Aristotelianism, Avicennianism, Thomism, and it may be that chronologically Aristotle comes first and that Avicenna and Aquinas refer back to him for sure, but perhaps as a higher level node above the three. And so there's something shared and something that there's differentia for each of these. But in any case, yeah, so then the question is, you know, if the critique of a Thomist and maybe Aristotelian, perhaps, I don't know if it's the case with Avicenna, that there is a sort of necessity to nature that's embedded in those systems, it would seem that when we put al-mumkin al-khas at the top, that's not the case for Avicenna. But I don't know. I'm just putting these ideas out here as a, you know, as part of my sort of learning process, and hopefully we all can learn from that as well. So if by putting them under the category of al-mumkin al-khas, then things could be otherwise, and that's where empiricism can enter in sort of later down the pike. And then the question is, does the concept of hayula and surah and jism and so on remain? Is it still useful or not with more empirical data? So that kind of leads to my third point, if I may. I mean, unless there's something that you wanted to clarify. I'm trying to go fast so other people can partake, but if you'd like to clarify something or you know, respond to anything I said, please go ahead. See that.
Sheikh Talal has a note. He said he would remove al-khas. He would just say al-mumkin at the top. He wouldn't say al-khas.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just, it's from the Sheikh al-Mudarris's text. So I'm forgetting the discussion. I just didn't retain the difference between al-mumkin al-am and al-mumkin al-khas.
Good consolidation. Thank you.
And it's not mine. It's just directly from the text of Sheikh Abdul Karim al-Mudarris. So then we have to figure out that mumkin al-am versus mumkin al-khas and how it pertains to this system and why. And unfortunately, I just didn't retain that information. next point is the echoes in modern science. The concept that, you know, that much of modern science, what we call in modern science, is a reaction to the Aristotelian system. And so I think I just want to emphasize one of the important points that came out of that is that both these systems, the Kalam system and the Aristotelian and Avicennian systems, are, you know, they're not disengaged from the empirical, but they're not primarily, you know, they're primarily aqli, they're primarily rational, it seems to me, and arguably rational and deductive, right? As opposed to the reaction to that came about in Europe, which was the emphasis on empirical and inductive, right? And so if we have aqli, you know, adi or hissi, and you know, wad'i or khabra sadiq, right? If we have our sort of three channels empirically, our three epistemological channels of rational, empirical, and divinely revealed for the sake of simplicity, then, you know, these earlier systems are primarily rational, right? And when we talk about rational knowledge, there's deductive and there's inductive, right? Whereas it would seem, and please everyone correct me if I'm wrong, that the modern science, quote unquote, perspective is to emphasize the empirical and the inductive over the rational deductive. And, you know, and as you mentioned, there's some good reasons for that in some cases. But the question that I think relates to Hassan Muhammad's question that was asked earlier is this free of philosophical underpinnings? Is it really purely empirical and inductive, or are there philosophical underpinnings that color the interpretations, especially as we interpret the quantum level, right? There's a number of schools about how we interpret the data of observations of stuff at the quantum level. So if modern science is a hybrid of aqli, of rational and, you know, and sort of rational philosophical assumptions and empirical inductive material, then it still seems worthwhile to engage with the philosophical assumptions, because, as you mentioned, Sidi, that, you know, maybe 1,000 years from now they'll look back on the science of the day and laugh at some of the things that we take to be most probably true based on apparently empirical observation or lots of empirical observation, though potentially colored with philosophical lenses, which leads to my what I hope is my final point, which is that these sections, I think, can arguably be seen as the physics section, right? So if you imagined a Kalam-based, university education that was really actualized and developed over time, then we might just call these classes physics, right? Regardless of your particular theological school as a Muslim, when you get a degree in physics or you study physics, you're studying the contemporary science of the day. And so it seems that the way a Kalam approach to all of this would be is, instead of just calling this Jawahir Nahra, then giving the Aristotelian and the Avicennian and then the Kalam responses of the day, it would sort of swap that out with physics, contemporary, state of physics and science today, via Kalam principles, which is, I think, how you ended the session, which is to talk about how all of this material can be viewed through these specific Kalam principles. And then from there, the state of science of any given day is less important, I think, right? If specific Kalam principles, excluding atomism in your case, if specific Kalam principles remain demonstrably true, then it doesn't matter if you have Hayula, if you think about Hayula and Surah, it's all contingent, right? Or it doesn't matter if you think about quantum particles and so on, it's all contingent, and then that all can be, you can accept the state of science even if it changes, right? So if that's one of the, if everything that undergoes change is in time, and whatever is in time is created, then these particular theories of science are created and are merely possible. Anyway, that's a little nerdy kalam joke. So I think that's an important overall take-home point that I wanted to mention. Like, so do we have to know the Avicennian position well? Do we have to know the Aristotelian position well? Do we have to know the Thomas position well? If so, you know, we have to keep in mind that the contemporary science is very much, or modern science, however you want to call it, is very much a response, a reaction to, right? A reaction to Aristotelianism in a similar sense that Kalam is a response to that, broadly using the term again. And so then there's always the question, well, are you, when you're constantly responding to an interlocutor who you think is incorrect, does that normative glare of the dominant interlocutor color your response? Are there risks with taking sort of unintended concessions and making them part of your doctrine, or making it necessary to respond to those interlocutors and make them part of doctrine? Can it put us into a sort of false dichotomy, or are there other possibilities that we might need to consider? So I think I'll just leave it at that. I hope that was useful or clear and clear. Those are my thoughts on it. I did touch on Hassan's question, but I can we can start from there. I'll turn it over to you, Sidi.
Thank you, sir. Okay, so shall I start? Or...
Please.
Okay, so can you stop the share?
Sorry about that, yeah.
Okay. So the first question is, when we say atomism as well as hylomorphism are relics of the past, atomism and hylomorphism are relics of the past. And modern science, based on empiricism, talks about a few new things. Do we also need to take into consideration the metaphysics of modern science? Yeah, I guess the brief answer is yes. So this is a problem that I work with quite frequently, and not at the deep philosophical level of philosophy of science discussions and cutting edge cosmology, but at the level of the average educated Muslim with a high school education in science. And what I found is that at that level, the only thing that's needed is to prove that the universe began to exist and that it's contingent and there's no natural necessity in the world, which was basically the only thing that the mutakallimun critiqued Aristotelianism through Avicenna. That was basically their only critique, and everything else can be yes, science changes. Maybe it's not completely accurate, and maybe it can be updated. But the question from a religious perspective is that if I believe that the speed of light, for example, is the same in all frames of reference, and this results in the theory of relativity and has implications for the passage of time when you move at a very high speed, and I believe that, is that going against any theological positions that I'm committed to as a Muslim? The answer will be no. Could it be that there are philosophical assumptions that are unsound, that result in a unsound depiction of the natural world? It could be. And so that's something that you can engage in and do, and you can improve. But I'm wary of overcomplicating the theological aspect of it. I think it's a very simple thing to do. And it's not difficult at the level of an average Muslim. And the reason why I'm not sure what words I used, but if I said relics of the past, the reason why I use that is not to undervalue the philosophical genius of the Avicenna and the Mutakallimun who made these arguments for atomism and hylomorphism, and they're very intelligent people, and their arguments are very sophisticated. It's not, I don't want to undervalue that. But what I think the point that I'm trying to make is that we shouldn't be bringing those things into the education, high school education of the average Muslim, in order to preserve their faith. That's just I think that it's not good theology. It's not effective. It results in confusions, and there's a different way to that should be done. So that's the clarification of my position and what I my intent when I say that. So.
Can I ask a quick follow-up question to that, if no one minds? Just, so, I mean, I think very quite a number of high school students will not get to skip high school physics. When I was a kid, it was a choice. I don't know at least at the high level, but nonetheless, you're going to study physics to some degree, whether you take a full class on it or it's worked into your various other high school science curricula all over the world, but especially in the Western context, which I think since we're doing all of this in English, we're assuming this is the general Western education curriculum is what we're engaging with in some way. So while it perhaps doesn't need to be mastered in the introduction to theology, nonetheless, if you're presenting the empirical facts, quote unquote, through a lens that is that does have certain philosophical underpinnings, do you just teach science with where you sort of note as you're reading through the text, oh, by the way, this is because they believe that at the quantum level things pop into existence without a cause, or this is because they have this particular belief of an infinite universe that's always been around, and here's the proofs against that, but now we can just take that information? Like, how do you prepare students to read to go through their science curricula without being bifurcated, right? Without having a sort of split personality of being, having a Muslim worldview outside of science class, and then having to adopt these a lot of principles in order to get through the just even basic high school level science.
So I'm actually doing that right now. Like, I'm working with schools. I have a textbook in the works and lesson plans, and so I can describe the way that I approach it. I have this first course, which is Why Islam is True, and in that course there you learn the argument for the existence of God, and which are contingency argument, Kalam cosmological argument, oneness, Dalil al-Tamanu, and the volitional agency of God, that he's a fa'il mukhtar, without any, like, you use necessity, contingency, but without any reference to substance or arad or anything. It's not needed. And then it's extended into laws of nature. You understand laws of nature from this, what are the irregularities? And there are some common, and you understand the Big Bang. And in light of this, we have a different understanding. And then after you do the Adillah of the Rasul, you look at evolution. You understand how you look at evolution in light of all of this. And then once you have these pieces, then this becomes the context for your education in physics. And there's nothing more that's needed in high school physics than that, because you'll study basically in high school physics, you'll study the Big Bang. You just have to understand that this is evidence that the universe began to exist, and there's the existence, the Kalam cosmological argument. And then in biology, there's evolution. And these are the two actual concrete issues. Everything else is just laws of nature. That's the only issue there. There's nothing more that I found. Now, if you go deeper, so the Kalam cosmological argument, if you go deeper into it, it opens up a host of different issues. The calculus comes in, limits come in, infinity comes in, philosophy of mathematics comes in, inference of the best explanation comes in. That's like a different level, though. You don't with evolution, two other things would come in. So Hashim says that soteriology, as is framed by Aristotelians, completely unimportant from an Ilmul Kalam perspective. So if by teleology, so for an Aristotelian perspective, teleology is the necessary, the natures of things. the natures of things and their potentialities and their actualization, necessary actualizations into something else as a final cause. So the seed is there so that it can become a tree. And so the things are there so that something else can happen. There's a line of causation goes back to the active intellect, which is thinking everything. And that's what gives the universe its intelligibility. So that's the way that they conceive of it. And now that teleology is problematic because it's as affiliated with necessary causation. But there's the opposite as well, because the reason why they do that is because they would say, Aristotelian would say, Thomist would say something similar, is that if you get rid of this, if you adopt a completely occasionalist worldview, then the world becomes incoherent because there's no reason why anything in the universe should be some other way. You get rid of purposes. So now, and it becomes anything is possible, but we don't say that. We affirm that things do have purposes, and that's because of the wisdom of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But his wisdom and knowledge is independent and of the actual physical manifestations in the universe. So so there is a teleology in this sense, but it's not there in nature. It's not there in nature. It's there in the action of God. So it would come through a different perspective. You want to have anything to add, Sidi Harun?
I think I've spoken enough. I'd love to hear from everybody else.
Okay, last question. It seems that modern science has sufficiently shown that Aristotelian natural philosophy was incorrect based on insufficient observations. However, modern medicine still seems to need to contend with Arab Greek medicine in terms of explanatory ability and treatment modalities. Is there a space for Muslim medical scholars to revitalize Yunani medicine that is based on humoral philosophy? So I guess it's the same thing, right? So when you have what does, just as contingency flattens Avicennism, Aristotelianism, and it gets rid of any kind of necessary assumptions in the universe, and it opens up the way for conceiving of the universe in a different way. Kalam does the same thing with modern science. So if, for example, homeopathy or Chinese medicine or Yunani medicine is not something that can be explained at the atomic level, and you can't find any kind of a chemical reaction in order to explain it, well, is it necessary? You know, is it necessary that there be a chemical reaction in order for an effect to be produced? It's not, because it's a regular association that's upheld by God. And so in the same way, it opens up the door for alternative modalities of medicine to be to have a way. But you have to make an argument for them, right? So this doesn't mean that Yunani medicine is correct, homeopathy is correct, Chinese medicine is correct, but it means that the door is open for an argument to be made over there that's not based on the chemical reactions, physical chemical reactions. So has that been done or not? That's a question that you would need to look at. Stop there. I think that Kalam, occasionalism, it frees the scientific mind. It makes you really open-minded, and you can really look at the empirical universe and come to coherent conclusions. And if it's not there, then there's always going to be an assumption. Aristotle has assumptions, modern science has assumptions, and the thing that flattens it all is Kalam. We'll stop there. صلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم.